channel. He had taken off from Le Barak near Calais shortly before 5 in the morning and landed in the Northfield Meadow by Dover Castle, covering a distance over water of 23 miles in just under 20 minutes. As it happened, Hartberg and Charles de Lambert were at Dover at the same time, and not far from where Blériot landed. De Lambert, too, had been planning to fly the channel, and he and Berg had come to look over possible landing places. A porter had awakened them at 4:45 that morning to say the wireless man at the hotel had just received a message that Blériot had left France. And as Berg wrote in a long letter to Wilbur and Orville, he and de Lambert were downstairs and on the beach inside 3 minutes. Only minutes after that, a telephone message was received that Blériot had landed on the other side of Dover Castle. "You have had all the details from the papers," Berg continued in his letter. "I can only supplement the fact that I had a long talk with Blériot afterwards. In fact, he used my room to wash up in, and the rest of the day wore my clothes. He told me that he had never been so thrown about in his life as when he got into this valley. He made 2 complete circles, and his machine was pointing out to sea when he came to the ground. The front chassis was wrecked, the propeller blades broken, but the wings and the tail of his monoplane were intact. Blériot was not hurt." From Washington, Catherine wrote to assure the bishop that the brothers were not at all disturbed by Blériot's flight, and as widely reported on both sides of the Atlantic, the brothers joined in giving Blériot due credit for his performance, which they characterized as remarkable. "I know him well," Wilbur said in an interview with the New York Times, "and he is just the kind of man to accomplish such an undertaking. He is apparently without fear, and what he sets out to do, he generally accomplishes." Orville noted the many accidents Blériot had had with a machine over which he had so little control, and expressed amazement that he had succeeded. Wilbur was asked if he and Orville would be making any attempts to win some of the prizes to be offered at the European air meets, such as that at Reims. "No, they would not," said Wilbur. "Their time would be put to better use," though what that was, he did not say. All the same, throughout France, indeed throughout much of the world, Blériot's flight was taken as only a prelude to the very burgeoning of French aviation that the New York Times had made so much of earlier in the year. As if by magic, everything started to work at Fort Myer as it was meant to. On the evening of July 27th, Orville took off with Lieutenant Frank Lahm as passenger on an official endurance trial, and in an hour and 12 minutes flew around the field 79 times at an altitude of 150 feet, not only passing the test, but breaking a world record that Wilbur had set at Le Mans the year before. An estimated 8,000 spectators saw him take off, and among them was President Taft. On Friday, July 30th, Orville flew what was the official cross-country speed trial required by the Army. The course covered from Fort Myer to Alexandria, Virginia, a distance out and back of 10 miles. Records of the speed flown varied, from 42 to 45 miles per hour, but there was no question that Orville passed the test. An especially smooth landing was made to the accompaniment of honking horns and cheering. Wilbur rushed to the plane, his face covered with a broad smile. Their contract with the War Department would be signed. The price to be paid by the department was $30,000, a figure that made headlines. But far more importantly, their own country was at long last committed to their achievement. "Orv finished the Fort Myer business in a blaze of glory," wrote Catherine, who, 10 months earlier, sitting by his bedside there at the post hospital, had wondered if he might ever have strength enough to walk again. 3. As reported in the Chicago Tribune, the eager interest shown by the French people in the progress of aviation could hardly be appreciated in America. And foremost among that summer's scheduled aeronautic events was the ROMS Congress of Aviators, where it is expected great things will be done. It was to be the world's first international air race, and financed entirely by France's champagne industry. Its official title was Le Grand Salon d'Aviation de la Champagne, and among the French aviation stars to take part were Henri Farman, Louis Blériot, Léon Delagrange, two of Wilbur Wright's protégés, Charles de Lambert and Paul Tissandier, flying French-built Wright planes, as well as the American Glenn Curtiss, who had been chosen to participate by the American Aero Club when the Wright brothers declined. At age 31, Curtiss was a lean, shy, intensely serious competitor, who, like the Wrights, had started out as a bicycle mechanic in his hometown of Hammondsport, New York, then began building and racing motorcycles. He became the first acclaimed American motorcycle champion, the fastest man in the world, achieving speeds on his motorcycle as high as 130 miles an hour. His interest in aviation had begun when a balloonist named Tom Baldwin asked him to build a lightweight motor for a dirigible. Once in September 1906, while in Dayton, Baldwin and Curtiss had visited Wilbur and Orville at their shop. Baldwin had thought Curtiss asked the brothers far too many questions, but, as he later said, they had the frankness of schoolboys. The year after, Curtiss met Alexander Graham Bell, who made him director of experiments for the Aerial Experiment Association. In 1909, with a wealthy aviation enthusiast who had worked with Octave Chanute and Samuel Langley, Augustus Herring, Curtiss formed the Herring-Curtiss Company to build flying machines. Those they built relied on movable flaps on the wings, ailerons, little wings, instead of wing warping, to control rolling and banking. The idea had occurred earlier to a young French engineer, Robert Esnault Pelletier, and had been tried by Saint-Audoumont, Blériot, and others. Alexander Graham Bell, too, had become interested, but whether on his own or having heard about Esnault Pelletier is not clear. Also, it had already been described for all to see, by the Wrights, as an alternative to wing warping in their patent published in 1906. But for Curtiss at ROMS, speed would be the point, and the small new biplane he would fly had been built strictly for that, with a powerful, lightweight engine. Anyone wanting proof of the pace of change in the new century had only to consider that just 1 year before, in August 1908, at Le Mans, all the excitement had been about one man only, Wilbur Wright, flying one airplane before about 150 people to start with. This August at Rennes, a total of 22 pilots would take off in as many planes before colossal grandstands accommodating 50,000 people. The grand opening took place Sunday, August 22nd, and by then Orville and Catherine had once more sailed for Europe, heading this time for Berlin, the brothers having concluded that demonstrations there were a necessity. Orville, as a result of his blaze of glory, was the one in most demand. Wilbur remained in Dayton, concentrating on motors with Charlie Taylor, and seeing to business of the kind he most disliked, including the commencement in mid-August of a lawsuit against the Herring-Curtiss Company for violation of Wright patents. Events at ROMS created an even greater sensation than promised. By the last days, the crowds numbered 200,000, four times the capacity of the grandstands. The contestants flew higher, farther, and faster than anyone ever had, breaking every record set by the Wright brothers in the past year, and the biggest winner, the most celebrated of the contestants, was Glenn Curtiss, who won the prize for speed. Nor was the excitement limited to France and the rest of Europe, as was clear from the American press. The great meeting at ROMS has been an electrifying, delirious success. The New York Sun. The scoffers scoff no longer. Washington Herald. The aviation tournament is only a hint of what the future will soon witness, when the sky shall become the common highway. Cincinnati Times-Star. This week at Rennes marks a new epoch and one of the most ambitious phases of human history. Atlanta Constitution. Overnight, Curtis was the new American hero, but only a week later, crowds as large as 200,000 turned out of Tempelhof Field in Berlin to see Orville fly. And in the course of his demonstration flights over the next several days, Orville, accompanied by a student pilot, flew for an hour and 35 minutes, a new world's record for a flight with a passenger. And at the same time, Wilbur had signed on to make his first ever public flight in the United States in New York. It was to be part of a celebration commemorating the 300th anniversary of Henry Hudson's ascent of the Hudson River, and the 100th anniversary of Robert Fulton's first steamboat on the Hudson. Wilbur was to be paid $15,000. Glenn Curtis, too, was to participate in the event. Writing to Orville aboard the train to New York on September 18, Wilbur reviewed some of the precautions he might take on the chance he would be forced to land his plane in the waters off Manhattan. An idea he had of using rubber tubes no longer made sense, so I've gone back to my old plan of mounting a canoe under the center of the machine, well forward, he wrote, adding, "Of course I do not expect to come down, but if I do, I will be reasonably safe." The canoe would be purchased in New York. The plane had already been shipped to the Army base of Governor's Island in New York Harbor, where Charlie Taylor would be joining him. The great sweep of New York Harbor and the Hudson River had become a spectacle beyond anything ever seen there, with 20 American battleships at anchor, a squadron of the Royal Navy, naval vessels from France, Germany, the Netherlands, Mexico, and Argentina, in addition to ferryboats, tenders, colliers, all manner of river craft, and the giant luxury liner Lusitania. No fewer than 1,595 vessels. Added to all this was the promise that for the first time New Yorkers were to witness airplane flights over their waters. On Governor's Island in Upper New York Bay, half a mile southeast of Manhattan, two hangars had been provided, almost side by side, one for Wilbur, the other for Curtis. When Curtis arrived to look things over, he and Wilbur greeted each other cordially enough and talked for 5 minutes or so, mainly about the events at Rennes. Wilbur excused himself from shaking hands, saying his hands were too greasy. At about this point, Guglielmo Marconi, inventor of the wireless telegraph, appeared on the scene, and was so thrilled to meet Wilbur, he insisted on shaking his hand, greasy or not. It had been arranged that whenever Wilbur or Curtis were about to take flight, Marconi would send a wireless message from Governor's Island to the warships in the harbor, and they in turn would raise flags as a signal to other ships and all on land. Curtis soon departed for Hemmonsport in upstate New York, where he was to be honored with an all-out homecoming. One day the reporters who hung about as close as permitted, hoping for a chance to talk to Wilbur, saw some small boys from the garrison approaching the guards, and expected to see the children rebuffed as they had been. Instead, they saw Wilbur, a kindly smile on his face, welcome them, then through the open doors watched as he explained every detail on the machine. "I've been here about a week and have the machine almost ready to fly," Wilbur wrote Catherine on September 26. He was staying at the stylish Park Avenue Hotel, but getting his lunches at the Officers' Club on Governor's Island. Yesterday was the big naval parade. In the evening, the boats were illuminated with millions of electric lights, and the same was true of many of the great buildings. For 10 miles, the river was an almost solid mass of steamboats, and but for the fact that they were nearly all outlined with electric lights, it would have been impossible to navigate. To reporters who descended on him, Wilbur said he had not come to astonish the world, but to give everybody a chance to see what the airplane was like in the air. Asked if he thought it would be a perilous flight over a harbor so filled with ships, he said an airplane ought to be able to go anywhere. Glenn Curtis returned from upstate late in the day on September 28 and camped that night in the hangar with his plane on Governor's Island in order to make an early test flight the next morning. As it was, he made his flight shortly after 6 o'clock, with only a friend and one Army officer as witnesses. He flew 300 yards, then went back to upstate New York. Wilbur, who had spent the night at his hotel in the city, did not get started with his preliminary tinkering until 8 o'clock, then about 9 o'clock took off on a 7-minute practice run circling Governor's Island, the white and silver flyer looking much as always except for the 14-foot canvas-wrapped red canoe that hung beneath. Thus the newest form of transportation was making its debut over American waters with one of the oldest of all forms, conspicuously in readiness in case of trouble. Soon after landing, Wilbur announced he would fly again. Wireless signals went out, signal flags went up, and off he went. Instead of heading toward the mouth of the Hudson, as expected, he swung to the west into the wind, and flying over 2 ferry boats, headed straight for the Statue of Liberty on Bedloe's Island, circled the statue, and sailed low over the Lusitania, which was then heading down the harbor, outward bound to Liverpool. Thousands of people were watching. Battery Park at the tip of Manhattan was thick with spectators, and passengers on deck the Lusitania frantically waved hats, scarves, handkerchiefs as Wilbur passed over their heads. He maneuvered his plane with perfect control through a whole series of dips and turns. But it was the spectacle of Wilbur Wright and his flying machine, circling the Statue of Liberty, that made the most powerful impression, which would be talked about, written about, and remembered more than anything, as a writer for the New York Evening Sun tried to express in a front-page account. Once, his great airplane so near the horizon that it seemed one of the ocean gulls among which it flew, just above the level of the feet of the Statue of Liberty. An instant later it appeared at the level of the statue's breast, and then passed in front on an even keel. In the air, Wright seemed to pause for a moment to pay the homage of an American aviator to the lady who attests his country's destinies. Then, turning suddenly eastward with the wind, he sped rapidly over the waves, while the harbor craft shrieked their welcomes, and the cheering men and women ashore bore witness that Our Lady of Liberty had been visited by one of her children in a vessel needing only the winds on which to sail. Harper's Weekly, the Journal of Civilization, would feature on its next cover a dramatic photograph of Wilbur in the plane circling the Statue of Liberty with the caption, "A New Kind of Gull in New York Harbor." "Goes pretty well, Charlie," Wilbur was reported to have said to Charlie Taylor when, after a smooth landing, he climbed from the plane back on Governor's Island. "Looks all right to me, Will," replied Charlie. The next day came news from Potsdam, Germany, that Orville had flown to an altitude of 984 feet, higher than anyone had yet flown in an airplane. Stiff winds out of the north kept both Wilbur and Glenn Curtis grounded on Governor's Island for 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, and by then Curtis announced he had to leave to keep a contract in St. Louis. This left only Wilbur to make the flight up the Hudson River that had been promised and all were waiting for. The morning of Monday, October 4, though the wind out of the north had eased off to a degree, it was still blowing at 16 miles per hour, or more than Wilbur would have preferred. Sensing it was only going to increase again, he decided to fly. The plane was brought out of the hangar, and he looked it over. Finding the gasoline tank not full, he took an old can and filled it himself. At 9:53, he took off from Governor's Island, the emergency canoe still hanging from beneath the plane. The one difference this time was a tiny American flag fixed to the rudder. It had been sent to him by Catherine, with the request that he fly it over New York. Again the wireless messages went off. Again signal flags were flying. Again whistles shrieked, foghorns sounded. Work came to a standstill in much of the city, and there was a stampede to the windows and rooftops of office buildings to see the spectacle in the sky of wonderful Wilbur Wright, the Dayton Aviator, as one New York paper was calling him. From the new skyscrapers, like the Metropolitan Life Tower, the view of the harbor and the Hudson River was panoramic. Most spectacular of all was the outlook from the upper floors of the 47-story Singer Building on Broadway, which, once completed, would be the tallest skyscraper on Earth. When Wilbur headed across the harbor and turned northward into the wind, heading for the Hudson River, the excitement grew even greater. He had climbed by then to about 150 feet and was moving at a speed of about 36 miles per hour. But on reaching the river, as he later recounted, he began getting air currents such as he had never had to cope with. They were coming off the skyscrapers, and so strong and dangerous he had to drop elevation considerably and hug the west or New Jersey side of the river. I went to a height just a little above the ferry boats until I reached the battleships, and then I skimmed over their funnels. I passed so close to the funnels I could smell the smoke from them. Asked later if one of the British battleships had fired a salute in his honor, Wilbur said he did not know what it was, but something made an awful noise. Seeing the dome of Grant's tomb on the right side of the river at West 122nd Street, he decided he had gone far enough, and after making a large 180-degree turn, he started south, back down the river, this time moving considerably faster with the wind behind him. I think I came back in half the time. I hugged the water much closer and kept further toward the Jersey shore as I passed the downtown skyscrapers. His return trip was greeted with enthusiasm as great or greater than that upriver. Now the Jersey hills were black with people, and piers and building roofs on the Manhattan side were packed to capacity. It was estimated 1 million people were watching. At precisely 10:26 a.m., Wilbur landed at Governor's Island within a few feet of the spot where he had taken off. His time in the air was 33 minutes and 33 seconds. The distance traveled to Grant's tomb and back was approximately 20 miles, his average speed 36 miles per hour. In spite of stiff winds, skyscraper gusts, whistles, horns, shrieking crowds and battleship salutes, he had done it. How formidable the wind problem had been could be measured by the small American flag Catherine had given him. Brand new at the start of the flight, it had returned in shreds. Charlie Taylor told reporters how extremely concerned he had been the whole time Wilbur was up. "I was staring with both eyes square at that big flag over the Singer Building. Sometimes it laid down and hugged the pole, and then I knew Wilbur was having it good. And sometimes it stood out pretty near even, and I knew he was having his troubles. And once it flipped right out and the tip began to point upward, like it did all day Saturday, I began to tremble, for I didn't know what Wilbur could do against a gust like that." "No, he had not conquered the air," Wilbur remarked to the press as he walked away. "A man who works for the immediate present and its immediate rewards is nothing but a fool." Shortly afterward, to much surprise, he announced he would fly again that afternoon, and this time it would be much farther, an hour-long flight in which he would circle Manhattan. But about 4 o'clock, as he and Charlie Taylor were cranking up the plane, the head of one of the engine's piston rods blew off with a terrible roar, and the head, which was about 6 inches long and 4 wide, flew like a cannonball, no more than 20 inches from Wilbur's head. To Charlie Taylor, he said, "It's a darn good thing that didn't happen up in the air." The plane was taken away. The New York performances were over. Talking with a correspondent for Scientific American magazine a little later, in the gathering dusk of the October afternoon, Wilbur was asked what the explosion of the engine indicated, and what direction the development of aviation would take in the future. "The broken cylinder was only an incident," Wilbur said. "As for the future, direction was the thing. High flying." "We must get up clear of the belt of disturbed air which results from the irregularities of the Earth's surface. From now on, you will see a great increase in the average elevation at which aviators will take their flights. For not only will they find in the higher strata more favorable atmospheric conditions, but in case of motor trouble, they will have more time and distance in which to recover control or make a safe glide to Earth." "On Monday, I made a flight up the Hudson to Grant's Tomb and back to Governor's Island," Wilbur wrote to his father 3 days later from College Park, Maryland. "It was an interesting trip and at times rather exciting. And that was that." He had come to College Park to begin training U.S. Army pilots. On Monday, October 18, 2 weeks after Wilbur's flight up the Hudson, Orville and Catherine were in Paris. Their events in Germany successfully concluded, they had stopped for a brief stay en route home, and by all evidence were unaware that shortly before 5 o'clock that afternoon, a Wright plane would appear in the sky, causing a sensation such as Paris had never experienced. It was not only the first airplane to fly over the city, but the first to fly directly over any city. Close as he was to New York, on his flight up the Hudson and back, Wilbur had flown over water only. The Comte de Lambert, having told almost no one his plans, not even his wife, had taken off from Port Aviation at Juvisy, 15 miles southeast of Paris. He was spotted first in the golden afternoon sky by hundreds of visitors high up on the Eiffel Tower. Then came shouts from the streets below, "L'aéroplane! L'aéroplane!" One of the most memorable descriptions of the spectacle was provided by the American writer Edith Wharton, who had just stepped from her chauffeur-driven limousine at the front entrance of the Hôtel de Crillon on the Place de la Concorde, and noticed several people looking into the sky, as she recounted in a letter to a friend. "And what do you think happened to me last Monday? I was getting out of the motor at the door of the Hôtel de Crillon when I saw two or three people looking into the air. I looked also, and there was an airplane, high up in the sky, and emerging on the Place de la Concorde. It sailed obliquely across the place, incredibly high above the obelisk, against a golden sunset, with a new moon between flitting clouds, and crossing the Seine in the direction of the Pantheon, lost itself in a flight of birds that was just crossing the sky, reappearing far off, a speck against the clouds, and disappeared at last into twilight. And it was the Comte de Lambert, in a Wright biplane, who had just flown across from Juvisy, and it was the first time that an airplane has ever crossed the great city. Think, what a soul was mine, and what a setting in which to see one's first airplane flight." What she neglected to say was that the Comte de Lambert had soared over the top of the Eiffel Tower, the tallest structure in the world, and thus had been flying at an elevation of at least 1,300 to 1,400 feet, high up indeed. Word of what had happened had already reached Juvisy by the time de Lambert returned and landed. Thousands had gathered to welcome him. Stepping from the plane, pale but radiant, he was instantly engulfed by reporters and an adoring crowd. There also, to his great surprise, were Orville and Catherine Wright. How they heard the news and how they got to Juvisy are not known. D'Alembert insisted he was not the hero of the hour. "Here is the real man," he said, turning to Orville. "I'm only the jockey. He is the inventor," by which he meant both Orville and Wilbur. Long live the United States. It is to that country that I owe my success. Once Wilbur, Orville, and Catherine reached home, they hardly had time to unpack before their time and attention were taken up with business decisions and patent issues, Wilbur heading off to New York one day, Washington another, then Wilbur and Orville going together to New York, then Wilbur going alone again. And except for Christmas, so it continued on into the new year. A Wright company for the manufacture of airplanes was incorporated, with offices on Fifth Avenue in New York. Ground was broken for a Wright manufacturing plant in Dayton. There were more dinners in their honor, more medals and awards, including the first Langley Medal, given by the Smithsonian. And there were more patent suits. With the increase in the number of people flying, there were increases in serious accidents and deaths. In France, aviators Eugène Lefebvre, Ferdinand Ferber, and Léon Delagrange were all killed in crashes. Extremely distressing, too, for Wilbur, was an unfortunate falling out with Octave Chanute that began in January 1910 and stretched into spring. Chanute thought the Wrights had made a blunder bringing suit against Glenn Curtiss, and said so in a letter to the editor of Aeronautics. Specifically, Chanute did not think that the idea of wing warping was original with the Wrights. In a letter dated January 20, Wilbur stated clearly to Chanute, "It is our view that morally the world owes its almost universal use of our system of lateral control entirely to us." In response, Chanute wrote, "I'm afraid, my friend, that your usually sound judgment has been warped by the desire for great wealth." Besides, Chanute was offended by something Wilbur had said in a speech in Boston about how he, Chanute, had turned up in the Wright shop in Dayton in 1901. This, Chanute felt, gave the impression that he had thrust himself upon Wilbur, and omitted to say that Wilbur had been the first to write to Chanute in 1900, asking for information. Wilbur and Orville found Chanute's letter incredible, and in one of his longest letters ever to Chanute, Wilbur let him know. Concerning Chanute's charge that greed had taken hold of the brothers, Wilbur dismissed it, saying simply, "You are the only person acquainted with us who has ever made such an accusation." He centered his considerable fury, instead, on the way Chanute had given the French the impression that he and Orville were mere pupils and dependents of his, and the fact that Chanute had never once, until now, expressed any question about the brothers' claim to the invention of wing warping. Neither in 1901 nor in the 5 years following did you in any way intimate to us that our general system of lateral control had long been part of the flying art. If the idea was really old in the art, it is somewhat remarkable that a system so important that individual ownership of it is considered to threaten strangulation of the art was not considered worth mentioning then, nor embodied in any machine built prior to ours. Plainly wishing the dispute to be resolved, Wilbur closed on a warmer note. "If anything can be done to straighten matters out to the satisfaction of both you and us, we are not only willing but anxious to do our part. We have no wish to quarrel with a man toward whom we ought to preserve a feeling for gratitude." When nearly 3 months passed, with no response from Chanute, Wilbur wrote again to say, "My brother and I do not form many intimate friendships, and do not lightly give them up. I believe that unless we could understand exactly how you felt, and you could understand how we felt, our friendship would tend to grow weaker instead of stronger. Through ignorance or thoughtlessness, Each would be touching the other's sore spots and causing unnecessary pain. We prized too highly the friendship which meant so much in the years of our early struggles to willingly see it worn away by uncorrected misunderstandings, which might be corrected by a frank discussion. This time Chanute answered in a matter of days, to say Wilbur's letter had been gratifying, that he had been in bad health, and was about to sail for Europe. I hope, upon my return from Europe, that we will be able to resume our former relations. Except for 1 week in February, it had been an unusually mild winter in Dayton. On February 16, as Bishop Wright recorded in his diary, more than a foot of snow fell, and it snowed very much again on February 18. But considerable thawing followed the day after, and he spent time breaking icicles off the roof. But with the first week of March, the snow was passing away. One bright, mild day followed after another. His diary entries recorded, "Beautiful weather, fine weather, spring weather, most beautiful weather, on into April." Dayton's west side, Hawthorne Street, and the Wright homestead looked as they had looked so often before in springtime. Gone were the homecoming flags and bunting and Japanese lanterns of the previous fall. All was as before. The West 3rd Street shop and the outlook from the interurban trolley on the ride out to Sims Station and Huffman Prairie were as ever. So, too, were the Wright brothers. For all they had seen and done, the unprecedented glory bestowed on them, it had by all signs neither changed them nor turned their heads in the least. There was no boasting, no preening, no getting too big for their britches, as said. And it was this, almost as much as their phenomenal achievements, that was so greatly admired. As one writer on the scene put it, "They are the imperturbable men from home as always." Catherine as well, for all her travels and the attention she had received, seemed no different than always. Poe was a mighty interesting place. Miss Wright stoutly insists on that, too, in spite of her brother Wilbur's dry smile. And there was pretty country in Germany, yes, he will admit to that. But if you want to see pretty country, you don't have to go any farther than their own field at Sims. Ohio is plenty good enough for him. And Orville agrees, mildly suggesting, however, that you can't really see it at its best till you get up about 1,000 feet. If the brothers might have had any cause for concern or annoyance, it would have been the lawsuit against the Curtis Company over their patents. But they were confident in their case, for which there was already strong support in the press and in the country. As said in the New York Times, it was a highly significant fact that until the Wrights succeeded, all attempts at flight with heavier-than-air machines were dismal failures. But since they showed that the thing could be done, everybody seems able to do it. Nor had the argument that patents by the Wrights would retard the progress of aeronautics made much headway. The insistence of Professor Bell upon his rights did not retard the growth in the use of the telephone, wrote the Christian Science Monitor. Thomas Edison's numerous suits for protection of his inventions have not kept any of them out of the market. And as both Wilbur and Norville knew better than anyone, if ever the development of an idea had been thoroughly documented, with written records and photographs, nearly every step of the way, it was theirs. Wednesday, May 25, 1910, was a particularly nice day in Dayton, noted Bishop Wright in his diary. It was also to be a very big day for the Wright family. The brothers had invited the Aeroplane Club of Dayton, as well as friends, neighbors, anyone interested, to come to Huffman Prairie to see Orville fly, and the crowd that came numbered 2,000 or 3,000. The interurban was jammed. Automobiles lined the roadway by the field, where ice cream and sandwich vendors had set up for business. As later reported, Orville performed with his machine in such manner as to keep the spectators on tiptoe the whole time. One minute he would be grazing the ground, and the next shooting up in the air like an arrow. He did figure eights, twists, and turns, all in the most remarkable manner. Most astonishing of all, he flew to an unbelievable height of 2,720 feet. And all the Wrights, the Bishop, Wilbur, Catherine, Ruchlin, Lauren, and his wife and children, were on hand to see such proof of the genius of the brothers' achievements performed there on home ground before a home crowd. In all the years they had been working together, Wilbur and Orville had never once flown together, so if something were to go wrong and one of them should be killed, the other would live to carry on with the work. But on this day at Huffman Prairie, where they had developed the first practical flying machine ever, the two of them, seated side by side, took off into the air with Orville at the controls. To many then and later, it seemed their way of saying they had accomplished all they had set out to do, and so at last saw no reason to postpone any longer enjoying together the thrill of flight. Of the immediate family of 7 Hawthorne Street, only Bishop Wright had yet to fly, nor had anyone of his age ever flown anywhere on earth. He had been with the brothers from the start, helping in every way he could, never losing faith in them or their aspirations. Now, at 82, with the crowd cheering, he walked out to the starting point, where Orville, without hesitation, asked him to climb aboard. They took off, soaring over Huffman Prairie at about 350 feet, for a good 6 minutes, during which the bishop's only words were, "Higher, Orville, higher." Epilogue. Except for one brief training flight he gave a German pilot in Berlin in June of 1911, Wilbur Wright was not to fly ever again, so taken up was he with business matters and acrimonious lawsuits. The Wright Company from the start demanded a great deal of time and attention, but it was the interminable patent infringement suits that put the most strain on both brothers. When we think what we might have accomplished if we'd been able to devote this time to experiments, Wilbur wrote to a friend in France, we feel very sad, but it is always easier to deal with things than with men, and no one can direct his life entirely as he would choose. Of far the greatest importance to both, more than the money at stake, was to secure just and enduring credit for having invented the airplane. It was their reputation at stake, and that mattered most. Their pride of achievement, quite understandably, was great. Eventually, 9 suits were brought by them, 3 brought against them. Over time, they won every case in the American courts. Octave Chanute, who had not returned from his trip to Europe until October of 1910, died at his home on November 23rd, at age 78, before he and Wilbur had had an opportunity to see one another again. On hearing the news, Wilbur boarded a train to Chicago to attend the funeral, and later wrote a long tribute to Chanute, published in Aeronautics, leaving no doubt of how he felt. His writings were so lucid as to provide an intelligent understanding of the nature of the problems of flight to a vast number of persons who would probably never have given the matter study otherwise. In patience and goodness of heart, he has rarely been surpassed. Few men were more universally respected and loved. In 1911, Wilbur spent a full 6 months in Europe attending to business and legal matters. Otherwise, he was either on the move back and forth to New York or Washington, or tied down at board meetings in Dayton. And it all began to tell on him. In Orville's words, he would come home white. Meanwhile, the family had decided to build a new and far grander house, very like an antebellum Old South mansion, in the suburb of Oakwood, just southeast of Dayton. Virtually all the planning with the architect was overseen by Orville and Catherine during Wilbur's time in Europe. Wilbur's one known expression of interest in the project was to request a room and bathroom of his own. In the first week of May 1912, thoroughly worn down in body and spirit, Wilbur took ill, running a high fever day after day. It proved once again to be the dreaded typhoid fever. Conscious of the condition he was in, he sent for a lawyer and dictated his will. One or another of the family were faithfully at his bedside. "Wilbur is no better," recorded Bishop Wright on May 18. "Wilbur was sinking," he wrote May 28. Wilbur Wright died in his room at home at 7 Hawthorne Street at 3:15 in the morning, Thursday, May 30, 1912. He was 45 years old. "A short life full of consequences," the bishop wrote. "An unfailing intellect, imperturbable temper, great self-reliance and as great modesty. Seeing the right clearly, pursuing it steadily, he lived and died." Phone calls and telegrams of condolence poured in from friends and neighbors in all parts of the country and abroad. 1,000 telegrams by that afternoon. Moving tributes were published in the days that followed. According to one Dayton paper, the quantity of flowers delivered to the house would have filled a railroad boxcar. Though the family would have preferred a private funeral, a public viewing of Wilbur's wasted remains took place at the First Presbyterian Church, during which an estimated 25,000 people passed by the coffin. At the conclusion of a brief service, burial followed at the family plot at Woodland Cemetery. "Wilbur is dead and buried," the bishop wrote. "We are all stricken. It does not seem possible he is gone. Probably Orville and Catherine felt his loss most. They say little." For the next 5 years, Bishop Wright continued to live with Orville and Catherine. Though no longer traveling on church work, he remained remarkably active. His life, like theirs, made notably different in a variety of ways as a result of the family's greatly enhanced affluence. He delighted in long outings in Orville's new automobile, with Orville at the wheel, and in the spring of 1914, after 42 years at 7 Hawthorne Street, the three of them moved into the newly completed white brick pillared mansion in Oakwood, which they had proudly named Hawthorne Hill. In 1916, Orville treated them to a summer-long vacation in Canada, in a rented house on an island in Georgian Bay. So enjoyable was the time that Orville bought an island of their own for further summers. The bishop kept on reading, writing articles for religious publications, and enjoying his morning walks. One October Saturday, he marched with Catherine and Orville in a Dayton women's suffrage parade. As near as he could judge, he was the oldest man in the march. Bishop Bilton Wright died at age 88 on April 3, 1917. Catherine, who never went back to teaching, devoted much of her time to Oberlin College, to causes like the suffragette movement, and to providing all the help she could to Orville. In 1913, she accompanied him on still another trip to Europe, on business to London, Berlin, and Paris. Attended by the faithful Carrie Grimbach, they lived at Hawthorne Hill, as comfortable with each other as always, until 1926. It was then that Catherine, at age 58, announced she would marry an old Oberlin classmate, Henry J. Haskell, a widower and journalist with the Kansas City Star. As fellow Oberlin board members, they had been seeing each other for some time, and though Orville knew Haskell and considered him a friend of the family, he turned furious and inconsolable. When Catherine insisted on proceeding with the wedding held at Oberlin, Orville refused to attend, or even to speak to her, feeling he had been betrayed. Of all Orville's peculiar spells, this was much the worst, the most regrettable, and for Catherine, painful in the extreme. She moved to Kansas City. 2 years later, when Orville received word she was dying of pneumonia, he refused to go see her. Only at the last did he change his mind, arriving in time to be with her at the end. Catherine died on March 3, 1929. Her body was brought back to Dayton and buried with her father, mother, and Wilbur at Woodland Cemetery. While Wilbur had virtually stopped flying after the flight he and Orville made together at Huffman Prairie in May of 1910, Orville continued piloting Wright planes for another 7 years. In September of 1910, he flew over Dayton, as no one had until then. A few weeks later, flying a new model Wright Baby Grand, he attained a speed of 80 miles an hour. As the years passed, he began experimenting with a new Wright hydroplane, then returned to Kitty Hawk to conduct gliding experiments, during which he set a soaring record of nearly 10 minutes, a record that would stand for 10 years. In 1913, within 2 months, he made some 100 flights and tried his hand at flying a single propeller plane. In 1914, he barely escaped being killed when his hydroplane fell into the Miami River. Orville had hoped to fly for as long as he lived, but had to give it up in 1918 at age 46 due to still lingering pains and stiffness caused by the crash at Fort Myer nearly 10 years before. By 1918, he had sold the Wright Company and established his own Wright Aeronautical Laboratory in a plain one-story brick building downtown, where he intended to concentrate his energies on scientific research. The financial rewards for their efforts and accomplishments had been considerable for the Wright brothers, though not as excessive as many imagined. In his will, Wilbur had left $50,000 each to brothers Ruchlin and Lauren, and to Catherine. The rest of his estate, an estimated $126,000, went to Orville. With the success of the Wright Company and its sale, Orville prospered far more. His total wealth at the time of his death was $1,067,105, or in present-day dollars, $10,300,000. Though a fortune then, it hardly compared to that of any number of multimillionaires of the time. If money had been his and Wilbur's main objective, Orville insisted, they would have tried something in which the chances were brighter. He thought it fair to say he was well-to-do rather than wealthy, and loved to quote his father, "All the money anyone needs is just enough to prevent one from being a burden to others." In the years following Wilbur's death, Orville had to face alone the burdens and tedium of continuing lawsuits. Further, he was outraged by an effort of the head of the Smithsonian Institution, Charles D. Walcott, with the help of Glenn Curtis, to rehabilitate the reputation of Samuel P. Langley, and in so doing, discredit the Wrights. Making the case that Langley's failure had been the fault of the launching device for his aerodrome, not the machine itself, the aerodrome was taken out of storage to be tested again. But, as was not disclosed, Curtis oversaw major modifications of the aerodrome, so that when tested once more in 1914, it performed with reasonable success, and the Smithsonian endorsed a statement saying, "Professor Samuel P. Langley had actually designed and built the first man-carrying flying machine capable of sustained flight." Before the aerodrome was sent back to the Smithsonian to be placed on exhibit, Walcott ordered that it be returned in its original 1903 condition. Orville's fury on learning of what had been done was momentous and altogether justified. Earlier, when he and Wilbur had offered their 19-3 flyer to the Smithsonian, they had been turned down by Walcott. In 1928, Orville sent the 19-3 flyer to England on loan to the Science Museum in London. Only then did the Board of Regents of the Smithsonian at last pass a resolution declaring to the Wrights belongs the credit of making the first successful flight with a power-propelled, heavier-than-air machine carrying a man. But it would be another 20 years before the Wrights' 19-3 flyer was returned from London and presented to the Smithsonian for display. And by then, Orville was no longer living. Of further aggravation were stories of others who had supposedly achieved flight before the Wrights, the most annoying being that of a German-American named Gustav Whitehead, who was said to have flown a plane of his own creation in Connecticut in 1901 and 1902. The story was entirely without evidence and wholly untrue, but kept drawing attention as the years passed to the point where Orville finally felt obliged to denounce it himself. In an article titled The Mythical Whitehead Flight, published in U.S. Air Services in 1945, he made plain that Whitehead was a man of delusions. Strangely, the story still draws attention, despite the fact that there is still no proof. Advances in aviation all the while had been accelerating faster than Orville or anyone of his generation had thought possible, and starting with World War I to a form of weaponry like nothing before in human experience. In 1927, young Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic to land in Paris, a feat once thought impossible by the Wrights. On his return to America, Lindbergh made a point of coming to Dayton to pay his respects to Orville at Hawthorne Hill, an event that caused excitement in Dayton of a kind not seen since the brothers had made their celebrated return from Europe 18 years before. Orville lived to see, too, the horrific death and destruction wrought by the giant bombers of World War II, and in several interviews tried as best he could to speak both for himself and for Wilbur. "We dared to hope we had invented something that would bring lasting peace to the earth, but we were wrong. No, I don't have any regrets about my part in the invention of the airplane, though no one could deplore more than I do the destruction it has caused. I feel about the airplane much the same as I do in regard to fire. That is, I regret all the terrible damage caused by fire, but I think it is good for the human race that someone discovered how to start fires and that we have learned how to put fire to thousands of important uses." As time went on, Orville grew increasingly inclined to withdraw from society, yet felt obliged to participate in a continuing number of public occasions in his honor, doing so in large measure out of respect for Wilbur's memory. He received honorary degrees from Harvard, the University of Cincinnati, the University of Michigan, and Oberlin College. In 1919, he received an honorary Master of Arts degree from Yale, the university where once, nearly 40 years before, Wilbur had hoped he might enroll. Orville attended the dedication of the Wright Library in what had been named Catherine Wright Park in Oakwood, and, having agreed to the removal of both the Wright Bicycle Shop and the family home at 7 Hawthorne Street, from Dayton to the Henry Ford Outdoor Museum, Greenfield Village, at Dearborn, Michigan, he attended their formal opening on what would have been Wilbur's 71st birthday. Of the numerous Wright monuments erected, the one dedicated to Wilbur at Le Mans in 1920 was the first. The largest, the Wright Memorial at Kitty Hawk at Killdevil Hills, was dedicated in 1932, with Orville present to accept it on behalf of both Wilbur and himself. A Wilbur and Orville Wright Memorial was created on Wright Brothers Hill, overlooking Huffman Prairie, and in 1945, an aircraft carrier, the USS Wright, was launched. Orville remained at Hawthorne Hill, looked after by Carrie Grumbach, and outlived Wilbur by 36 years. He lived to see aviation transformed by jet propulsion, the introduction of the rocket,